Mini episode 694 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to our History of the Royal Rumble anthology here in the FDH Lounge. Rick Morris and Kyle Ross breaking it all down for you. Of course, if you want to get an overview, our thoughts on the Rumble as a whole, how it came to be, the structure of it, etc., go back to Part 1A, 1988. This is Part 6A, 2008, 20 years after the original Royal Rumble came to be, and the 20th show that was on pay-per-view, as the first one was on the USA Network. So we are entering a new era here as far as how we have come to define these, look at these over a period of time. And as the intellectual architect, as you will, of our blueprints here, let's get your thoughts, Kyle. What was the reason, and I agree with it, by the way, but I'd like to hear you delineate it for the audience here.
Oh, it's very nice when you agree with something I do.
It happens in this case here. By the way, I don't think you'll agree with me, and I'd like to dedicate my portion of this segment here to the great Justice Nino Scalia. Rest in peace. I don't suppose you'll join me in that regard.
Rest in peace is right.
But as we go to, so ending the era in 2007, starting it in 2008, your reasons, Kyle Ross.
Well, in my notes here, I have at the very top, why start a new part here, ?
Okay.
So let me see if I can answer that question.
All right.
It absolutely, and this is part six that we're starting now, right?
Yeah, 6A. Okay.
The line is definitely fuzzier between 2007 and 2008 than it is compared to the other lines that we've drawn. So let's go back. We drew a line between 92 and 93. That was our first line.
That's right.
Part one was 88 to 92. It was called the beginning to the best.
Right.
No, 92, commonly regarded as the best Rumble of all time. That's something else we agree on, by the way.
Right.
93, you look at it, there was no Hogan on that show. It was clearly different 1 year later. There were so many differences, and people can go back and listen to 93 to hear all those differences.
Right.
We then drew another line between 95 and 96. That one was maybe not quite as obvious if you're just watching those two shows, because you're still kind of in a deader era of the company, but we drew that line based on the Monday Night Wars.
Right.
So that now, made sense.
Although you cut off the Wars while they still had a little bit to go. The beginning and the end of that next era is a little bit fuzzier, although I don't fundamentally disagree with
No, and then the next line was between 99 and 2000. You're right, the Monday Night Wars. But the Monday Night is a war.
Yeah.
It wasn't a war anymore. It was one side was bleeding to death.
Right.
And when you look at 2000 to 2002, which was our next section, from the war to the game,
right,
that was really, although casual interest had dipped from 98, 99, those were really the peak years of the company.
Right.
In terms, it made its most money, and they really had bolstered the mid-card, bringing guys over from WCW.
Right.
2002 to 2003, we drew another line. That one's much clearer.
Yeah.
That's when they decided to split the roster into two brands.
Right.
So now we make our next cutoff between 07 and 08, and why? Well, that split they'd done, and we talked about this, I believe, at the end of the 07 episode.
Right.
Right? The split they'd done became a lot softer.
That's right.
Midway through 2007. It was actually April of 07, I believe, that Backlash show, which is actually a good show if you go back and watch it.
Right.
They no longer were doing Raw only and SmackDown only pay-per-views.
Right. Although, as I said at the time, depending on how you define it, No Way Out in February. The main event was the SmackDown WrestleMania main event versus the Raw WrestleMania
main event.
But I think
it was still technically a SmackDown
show. The rest
show.
Of it was SmackDown only. Yeah.
Yes, but Backlash 07 was a
full-on, first full-on.
And we, of course, have ECW now, too, for whatever that's worth, and it ain't much. So we do have that the brand extension is sort of muddled. It's not the clear Raw roster, SmackDown roster, although the shows you're typically on, it's not as soft as it would become as we move through this
era, right.
Where basically, you know, you have the SmackDown champion appearing on, like, there's just no point. Like, why do you even have two champions? But whatever, we'll get to that.
To where it feels like it's WCW 93,
with
where you
the
have
international
two
world title,
exactly.
Stuff like that. So I really think that is key in that the novelty of seeing Raw and SmackDown guys on the same show.
Right.
Not what it was. Remember we talked about it was 05.
Yeah.
That's part they did in the Rumble where they had the four Raw guys turn and face the four SmackDown guys, and it got a huge pop.
That's right. And
we pointed to that as a sign, hey, this brand split thing was kind of working in that regard. Whatever. We can go back to the different podcasts.
Right.
Personally, I think splitting the world titles, splitting the brands, I don't think it necessarily made the company any better.
Right.
I don't know if it made it worse, but I certainly know it didn't make it any better.
It democratized the airtime, which it was designed to do, because you'll look at today, and it's the same guys more or less kind of on both shows, but by the same token, it's a thing where it didn't benefit you to give airtime to all these guys.
No, and the mentality behind doing it is it would be quote-unquote easier to create new stars.
Right.
Because you would be forced to. That really didn't happen outside of John Cena and Batista.
That's right.
I don't think. And there's a few other guys who
subsequently
got,
Edge.
Yeah, there's a few guys who certainly were able to rise to prominence in a manner maybe they wouldn't have if it was all just one brand. But
possibly, yeah.
I don't think the overall numbers of created stars from 03 to 07 is what had been intended, certainly.
No. And there's a
or
lot of guys.
Ideal.
And again, I know we've probably gotten to eye-rolling territory on this now, but I keep referring to this with the 2000s, the Lost Generation. There's a lot of guys who they were counting on to become part of that vanguard who should still be going strong today, which, as you've pointed out today, being the winter of 2015-2016 as we're recording this. And again, the paucity in there of that, the fact that we can count on one hand guys who became main eventers in this era and became strong players going forward. And we start to really kind of see that in this era.
Okay, so the delineation between he's a Raw guy, he's a spectacle. To be honest with you, when I watched this 2008 show, I had some difficulty remembering who was on what show. Not, I mean, there were the obvious ones, and certainly when you're in the title match, it was obvious. Well, but I had to, on the Wikipedia page, they have them colored.
That's right.
And I was like, oh, this guy was on this. You know, it wasn't like, and I'll get into this in a little bit about my own viewing during this period. But it wasn't as easy to recall what was going on with these guys as it was in the couple of years previous.
That's right.
At least in my opinion.
Well, the other thing, too, when you're talking about brand splits and the relative meaninglessness of them relative to what it once was, is that by 08, I'm pretty darn sure, as I think back on it, that they had gone to the idea of the SmackDown/ECW working relationship or whatever, to where you had a lot of back and forth between the shows that was explained away as a result of, well, they're working together, they're sharing talent. In reality, it was the thinness, the paucity of the rosters dictating it.
Yes, which was a problem throughout the brand extension era, is that the rosters just became too thin because of injuries a lot of times.
Yes.
You know, when there was a major injury during this period, it really screwed up a brand, usually more so SmackDown. I mean, SmackDown was always given the shaft. It was clearly the B show at this point. There's no denying that. I still think going into WrestleMania 24, you had two viable world title matches. That becomes a bigger issue as we move on.
Absolutely.
But I still think that they could get away with having two world titles as we turn to 2008.
Right.
But the point of having it
right
was becoming You couldn't make as compelling a point to have two world champions as we move through 2008.
You mentioned the injuries. Two things you've mentioned previously as far as a line of demarcation here, which I think apply. We've talked about this before. One is, and the Rumble itself would be the first ever show that was in HD. So technologically, they're taking a step forward. The other thing being, at some point in 2008, I don't remember exactly when, but they became a PG product. But that was formalizing what started to happen during the previous year, post-Benoit, when moving towards, we're putting smiles on people's faces. Yes.
In addition to HD, just another, well, this isn't cosmetic, really, but it's certainly notable. Around this time, CW canceled SmackDown.
Okay.
That's something else that plays into softening the brand extension. And where did they go after?
Was it My Network TV?
Yes, My Network TV. I couldn't even remember.
Which is a polite word for syndication. That wasn't really a network so much as syndication.
So you can see why, without reliable television, why they began to get maybe cold feet on trying to do two evenly booked shows, which, let's be honest, they had given up on years before. Well, SmackDown had always sort of gotten the shaft when it came to booking and star power, really going all the way back to 2004.
Right. But both brands suffered. Coming into this show, it was a period of recovery. But you had a thing there again. And as I said to you off air, we remember 07 from the midpoint on as being a horrific point in time for the company because of Benoit.
Yes.
Afterwards, the bad media from it, the congressional investigation, whatever. In just preparing for this show here, I turned up some stuff that indicates I think we would remember 07 as having been a bad year, even if Benoit never happened, which I know is kind of a shocking thing to say. But when you look at the depth of the rosters here, keeping in mind late the previous year, late 2006, Angle and Big Show both move on. So they're both out of the picture. In late 07, there would be the suspensions coming. Booker T would leave. This was as a result of the scandals post-Benoit, the drug testing, whatever. Major injuries in 07 at various points along the way, because it's tempting to think of today, again, the winter of 15-16, as being the largest scale epidemic of injuries in the company history, with everybody that is going to be out going into WrestleMania 32 and how bad it is. I would argue 07 was maybe as bad. You go top to bottom. Obviously, Benoit would be out for the rest of his life. Beyond that.
One way to put it.
Yeah. Triple H and Ray coming back at SummerSlam, Cena, Michaels, Undertaker, MVP, Edge, and Bobby Lashley. Bobby Lashley,
never came back.
Yeah, a guy who at WrestleMania
was positioned as a future of the company.
Yeah, supposed to get the rocket through his ass from the Donald Trump rub and never to be heard from again after August. So it's a weird thing because when I found this stuff, when I was looking at the landscape coming into 08, it was disconnected from my original observation on watching the show. And now I realize I sort of have a unified theory coming into this show because I was looking at it. You told me going in, I think you had indicated you thought that 08 was a good one. And so I was like, okay.
The Rumble show
was a good one.
Or I should say the Rumble match.
Well, and that's a thing where part of it is from being an MSG because there's that crackling energy that's just there that isn't there in a lot of places. But I'm watching this show and I'm feeling the buzz and I'm feeling the urgency. And keep in mind, I hate the 2000s. I wouldn't wipe my ass with the 2000s.
No, wait a minute.
I'm leaving out 2000 to 2002, obviously.
The late 2000s.
Mid to late 2000s I loathe, okay? So nobody's more surprised than me that I loved this show as a whole, and I really liked this Rumble. And I thought to myself, why is there such urgency for this? Particularly, spoiler alert, we'll talk about this more with 09. There's no urgency to 09, folks. Spoiler alert. Then there's none. Coming up on the 25th WrestleMania, no urgency. And I'm thinking to myself, how do you have it some years and not other years, arguably when you need it more the next year? And then my unified theory is they were urgent because they needed to be. Because they were coming off, I think, the worst stretch since Montreal 10 years ago. I think that the dark clouds hanging over this company were the worst
that they
had been.
Well, this was much worse than Montreal.
Oh, sure, sure. But that's...
This was as dark as anything since maybe ever. I mean, the only story that is compared to Ben, that can be in the same neighborhood as Benoit, would be the steroid stuff.
Sure.
And all the scandals, you know, the Pat Patterson scandal, the steroid scandal, the Rita Chatterone scandal, like, all those scandals kind of adding up.
Right.
Sort of equaled this.
Right. And the thing of it is that this is such an era of just, we talk about this, an era of just such mediocrity and year to year, same old crap, whatever. But I came to realize on watching this what an accomplishment it was, maybe on par, and I know this is going to be controversial to say, with the WrestleMania season of 98, because even though all it did was keep them in the mediocre holding pattern, that's an accomplishment. They dug out of how bad late 2007 WWE was, and that is no small feat. Just to get back to their mediocrity was a Herculean accomplishment. I think this WrestleMania season, starting with the Rumble, was very successful in stabilizing them and at least keeping them on this crappy kind of plane that we kind of look down upon as opposed to something much, much worse.
On that note, with the WrestleMania season, please, please remind me later on to bring up the business numbers. I don't want to do it right now because there's a certain match that I want to introduce the business numbers in in terms of pay-per-view buys, and because the numbers were good for this show.
Okay.
We should point that out, but I don't want to talk about that right now. What I do want to talk about, and we've obviously sort of danced around and flat out mentioned, is Benoit.
Yes.
Because it's obviously the darkest moment, I think, in company history.
Yes.
And it's another reason why we can do a line of demarcation, because although it hadn't happened yet here, we still see blood on this show.
Yeah.
We still see Playboy mentions on this show.
Yep.
The shift in company philosophy, I can't remember the exact moment when it happened.
Yeah.
Because there was still blood actually throughout away, because they had that bloody Jericho-Michaels feud.
This was like, this was not 1159, but this was maybe 1125 of the post-Attitude era.
Yes. There clearly started to be a shift in terms of company philosophy.
The other thing, too, part of it is the natural evolution of a corporation like WWE. Look, as far back as the Attitude era, one of the things was they weren't able to fully monetize stuff because of sponsors. And over a period of time, it got to be, I think during the Attitude era, they could justify it. It was like, we're making money hand over fist. Okay, if we're not getting as much off of the sponsors, then that's another thing. You get further and further along, you got a kid-friendly guy always on top like John Cena, and you start to say to yourselves, wait a minute, we're not going to go full bore to try to please sponsors because why? And I'm not defending that as a wrestling fan, because as a wrestling fan, I hate that mentality. But from a business standpoint,
it's incredibly important right now.
But
when
as
you talk to people
yeah.
in the company, it is incredibly important to serve that master.
Yes.
Sponsors.
Yes.
The TV deal.
Yes.
That matters more than doing, quote-unquote, the right wrestling thing.
This is what happens in the free market, absolutely. So we're kind of seeing that. They're moving towards this trade-off.
Yes. Again, this is kind of minor, I guess, in a grand scheme.
Mm-hmm.
But John Cena is clearly the guy going into 08. Now, it's interesting because going into this show, he was considered persona non grata. He was hurt. You referenced that injury.
He was mentioned for the first time with about 15 minutes to go in the show for deliberate reasons.
Yes, and we'll get to that
in
a moment. But you know what I'm saying? Like, it's funny when you go back to 07, and I think one of the big storylines here in Part 6 is the importance of winning the Rumble being a little diminished. We had talked about that previously in the brand, in the Split Happens Part 5 era, where because you now have two world title matches.
Mm-hmm.
We'd seen multiple times where the runner-up of the Rumble also wound up being
the previous
title picture
three friggin' years.
Yeah. But in 07, Undertaker wins the Rumble and is not even in the last match. Like, it had gotten They had gone to the point, not 06.
Well,
he
wasn't wrestling
was
Cena, that's why.
Either.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they clearly had made John Cena the top guy. Like, when they had Cena still go on last at WrestleMania 23, they were sending a clear message. The John Cena match is the more important match.
Have you ever heard the backstory with Batista and Undertaker being upset about that?
Follow that. Well, you know, okay, sorry, Dave. John and Sean actually had a better match. But nice try.
I'll probably watch that to see. I don't remember.
It's not a lop. It's not a blowout, but it's bad. Uh-huh. The Cena-Michaels match, when I watched that somewhat recently, mm-hmm. I was shocked how good that was.
Okay.
For a match that it was very obvious who would go over,
mm-hmm.
I was stunned how good it was. I shouldn't be stunned because it's freaking Shawn Michaels.
Right.
But it was better than I remembered, I'll say that.
Okay.
So we have these kind of little changes. The company's built around Cena, who had gotten hurt. I mean, that was really the biggest injury in the second half of 07.
That's right.
Without even dropping the title. They got cued at SummerSlam.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to drop it to Orton, remember?
Yeah.
And then Vince did one of his things where he thought too many people knew, and he changed the plan at the last minute. And then Cena wound up getting hurt and never could drop it to Orton.
He also didn't drop it in September. They had one more chance. It's October, No Mercy, where...
A show that did surprisingly well, by the way, because they promised new champion. But no, was he... I don't know if he got hurt at SummerSlam, but all I know is they were going...
No. He got hurt right before No Mercy in October. I mean, like the week before. So there was one more chance to get the belt off of him.
Yeah,
they really screwed
why they
up.
Didn't. Yeah, they got too cute for their own good.
They were dragging it out.
Yeah. But Cena,
in fairness, it was, and it's hard to remember a time, right? Because we're all so jaded by these two guys being in the ring. It was the first major Cena-Orton feud ever in late 07. These guys hadn't locked up in the 2 or 3 years that they'd both been big stars. So it meant something at the time.
Yeah, that was the only thing worthwhile in that SummerSlam show.
Right.
By the way, that was a terrible SummerSlam show aside from that match.
The returns were interesting from a storyline perspective anyways.
Guess, yeah.
Okay.
There have been worse SummerSlams, but not many. I also want to get into one other thing before we start with the actual 08 Rumble show.
Okay.
On a personal note, I think 2008 to 2010 is the nadir of my wrestling fandom. Now, no secret, personally, I had some things going on during this period. Like, especially, like, not yet, but like in 09, I was, whatever, I was just a depressed individual, and I didn't care anymore. And I'll be honest with you. I didn't watch a ton of wrestling in these 3 years. I had to do my homework to go back and watch this. It was to the point where I certainly wasn't ordering the pay-per-views on a monthly basis.
Right.
But I watched this live. I watched this one live because the Cena return caught me off guard.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched WrestleMania in 08, but I don't remember watching any other of the pay-per-view shows, really. And I just... Personally, for me, I was going to make 2008 to 2010 its own little part. This is where I'm just going to put a bow on it here.
Yeah.
And then I'll let you reply. But you, who are further ahead in your viewing, now I've seen all these shows, but you're further ahead in your reviewing, I should say.
I've actually completed it as we're sitting here now, which
pointed
is interesting.
Pointed out that there was a common theme from 2008 to 2013 where you still had the two world champions that... The winner of the Rumble, it didn't seem to be as important as it had been before, and certainly is now again,
right.
Where the winner is the challenger.
Right. It's make or break for WrestleMania.
For WrestleMania.
Yeah.
So what we're going to do here, part six is going to be 08 to 2013. That's a pretty big part.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be called What the Split and the Decline of the Rumble. When we get to 2011... We're going to have to talk more because there's some interesting changes between 2010 and 2011. But overall, you know, that line, to draw a line between 2010
right.
and 2011, that would be even softer, I think, than what we have here between 07 and 08.
It's an interesting thing that you mentioned, too, because in terms of the dynamic of watching these shows and periods of time, and you and I, it's a really interesting thing, just to kind of break kayfabe a little bit. SNS was done in early 07.
Mm-hmm.
And as
that was the show I was on.
As sometimes happens.
My good friend Ryan Ward.
You know, and this is this is not a good thing when it happens, but sometimes you just when people leave an entity that you're still a part of, you're not really in as much touch with them, whatever. So these are sort of the wilderness years for you and I, because it's a thing of like, I would have like a vague thing of, oh, I like to reach out to Kyle, but I like feel weird about like, when I haven't talked to somebody in a while, are they going to really want to talk to me or
we
whatever?
Didn't talk
it's like,
a lot these years. I don't remember.
I kind of get in my own head about that. Yeah. You know, it's like,
well, I had some issues. I mean, like I said, in like 2009 and 2010 are not very good years.
No,
like 2010,
no.
Everyone would expect to be the worst year of my life. It was actually like 2009 because I was just depressed and worried about everything.
And so, I didn't know about any of that till 2010. And then when I did, then I reached out to you and we got to be back in touch. And it was like it was a glide path sort of getting back to where we are now, personally and professionally. But it's interesting for me to hear you talk about this because these are, you know, I got to know you late 2005, been friends with you since then, but these are sort of the wilderness years for you and I. So it's interesting to get that window on
so
the perspective.
I don't think there's no, when we talk about these next three Rumbles then, there's no shared experience between you and I in
That's
talking
right.
about it. Like the other ones, it's like, you know, I probably asked you when we get to 2011 and stuff, I probably asked, oh, what did you think of that show at the time? And
right.
we were able to speak.
And when we were both
term.
At the Sports Talk Network, we both, if we didn't watch all of them together, then at least we were very much talking about it.
So these ones are ones that it was, you're right, out in the wilderness is kind of an interesting term. So let's get into it now that we've gotten through that monster setup.
Sure.
So as much as we made it seem doom and gloom coming into this show, and you mentioned this already, and I'm going to second it, this is not a bad show at all. As a matter of fact, it's quite good. I like the opening. I just want to make a note to that. With the
I do,
Subway.
Too.
That was one of their better openings to a pay-per-view ever, where they showed the guys fighting in the subway. Of course, the show's in MSG in New York. I don't think they've done a bad pay-per-view in Madison Square Garden. They don't do them anymore, as we know.
Unfortunately.
I asked you this before we went on. Can you name a bad pay-per-view they did in MSG?
Not off the top of my head. And that's where it's a shame because...
Or at least one that wasn't memorable, like... The first SummerSlam was in MSG, right?
That's right.
88. I mean,
you
I guess
that's
whack not
that far. Yeah.
I mean, that's not a great show, but it's kind of memorable. I mean, back then, a pay per view is such a big deal,
right?
That even if it was kind of the phoned in by modern standards, no good matches type affair that first SummerSlam was,
or WrestleMania 1.
Yeah.
Well, the undercard on that was
but WrestleMania 1 is probably the most important show in company history.
Sure.
Right.
Sure. It was important for that.
There just aren't – I just feel that, for whatever reason, they try real hard when they go to MSG.
Yep.
It's a shame
that they don't go back.
All the, you know, the –
because you can't compare a Meadowlands or Newark or Barclays show to MSG.
Although
you just can't.
Although
sometimes
Barclays
comes
close. There's some talk that they're going to make Barclays the permanent home of SummerSlam now. Wasn't there been some discussion about that? And that's always a good crowd. I mean, the New York market is always a good crowd, but it's something about being an MSG, because you know why? It dawned on me. It looks different because they can't do the normal setup.
Right.
It just looks different, and one of the problems with drawing lines of demarcation in this year is that everything just sort of looks the same, you know?
Yeah, which is not good.
I mean, I don't know. I guess
I don't like the uniformity.
There's arguments for and against. I think, look, I've talked about this going all the way back to SNS in 06. They've come up with a formula that that while the drawback is it limits their ceiling, what they can do, it also prevents the floor from dropping to the point where they were in like 1994.
Right, but part of it is too, I'm going to use this as an example. You're not nearly the baseball fan that I am. I liken it to that, of like, I've never been to a game at Minute Maid Park. I'd love to do that. I've never been to the park in Frisco. I'd love to go there. And it's like, I'm not saying that wrestling, you know, arenas are like that, but I mean, to watch something in MSG, you're right, it's special. And what's interesting is there's still a little bit of a difference from 10 years before when they did SummerSlam there. That was where it had the full-on old-school look, hard cam, facing the tunnel, whatever. This time, they had like a quasi-Titantron-ish type thing behind it.
Yeah.
And it was like...
Yeah, that's right.
It was still MSG, but it was MSG with modern touches, and that didn't bother me.
No, I thought it was great. The crowd was great.
Yeah.
It just looked different. And I have in here. I just really miss them doing shows at MSG. You
I
mentioned this is the first pay per view they ever did in HD. They were really making a big deal about that.
Yep.
Throughout the show, I guess watching it, I mean, obviously I'm watching these on the network now. I guess it looked better.
Here's the thing, too. Did you get the sense that it looked marginally? Here's the thing. And this is a contradiction. I know, marginally darker, but not in a bad way. But it seemed to be like a little bit of a grittier look, but in a positive way. I don't know.
Okay. I didn't get that.
All right. Because MSG always was dark back in the day, like when you watch the 70s shows and whatever.
Oh, yeah, it was nothing like
that.
It was nothing like that,
but I felt like they tapped into it in a tiny, tiny way. Maybe that's
my
imagination.
I was just trying to think, like, unfortunately, that I don't have it up in front of me right now, like watching 07 on the network comparing to 08 on the network. I guess it's significantly better.
Yeah.
It makes sense. So let's get to the card.
Okay.
We should mention, and we'll talk about him momentarily, JBL out of the commentary booth. We have like 600 commentators at this show, by the way.
Yes.
JBL now in going back to a wrestling role. So the coach is with Michael Cole on the SmackDown side of things. Not one of your better announced teams.
No.
Okay.
No, there's not. By the way, one other macro note before the show.
Why were the ECW guys there?
I was just going to say, this is...
Styles and Taz. There was no ECW title match on this
Full-blown WWE CW by this point. I mean, by 07, they were almost totally there with Heyman out of the mix and Lashley on top. But by 08, would you agree with me? I mean, we were totally into the era of WWE CW. I mean, it's not. It doesn't even have a tiny, tiny...
I thought as soon as Heyman left after December to dismember, that
like immediately?
Debacle,
I thought 2007 was like a transition year in my mind. I don't know.
Well, that was the end of the year, December to dismember. It was like November. Or no, it was obviously it was December. What am I talking about?
That's what I'm saying.
December.
It was only a month before the 07 Rumble. You thought it was that quick that it was full-blown WWE CW?
At this point, it was.
Well, by 08, yeah. But that's what I mean. Like, to me, 08
well, no,
was
December
the
to December. That was 2007, right?
No, it was 2006. This was 13 months after that,
oh,
Kyle. Because you were reviewing it. You had the infamous
right.
review
yes.
Sunday night submission.
You're right. It was 07 that it became
WECW. And by this
yes.
show here, it was like... You're like, why do you still have Joey Styles? Because you have nothing else in common with what ECW used to be.
Yeah, I would agree.
It was like, what's the
you're
point?
Right. I mean, there was no point for them to be okay. there except to have six announcers for the Rumble, which I didn't like. But anyway, let's talk about this show. Because
sure.
it's a good show, and I think we've been very negative for 20 minutes. And let's try to...
I think we've been balanced.
Let's try to say some positive things. By the way, I felt guilty during the open, one last thing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was an AC/DC song, and I like hate AC/DC. And I looked it up, and it was just some generic band, and I felt like okay for liking it. I was like, God, I don't want
to... I thought it was them, too, and I love AC/DC. Okay.
Right. Yeah, had I come to the realization that I sort of didn't mind an AC/DC song in 2008, I would have wanted to take a shower. So
I'm not
going to
defend. Didn't one of their guys just get unmasked as a Nazi or something like that? I don't remember what it was. There was a big scandal with one of those guys. He got drummed out of the band. I'm not going to defend
No, I think he was hiring people to kill people or something like that. Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was
maybe
really,
you're right.
It was bad, yeah. I don't know. I'm not a big AC/DC fan. Anyway. You know who I am a big fan of, though?
Who?
Ric Flair.
Me too.
And
best of all time.
I would agree with that. Although Shawn Michaels says hi from an in-ring perspective. So Ric Flair wrestles MVP in the opener of this show, an odd pairing. And in case our listeners have forgotten, this was during the period where Rick was working the retirement angle, which obviously culminated him losing to Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 24
right.
and never wrestling in WWE again.
Yep.
So the storyline was, and we're going to talk a lot about this, I have a feeling, that if Flair lost a match, he was done. Vince just kind of out of nowhere, as you ranted before we went on the air, came up with this edict. It was sort of a storyline. Came up with it.
Throw away. Next time you lose, you're done, period. You know.
I mean, I didn't mind the idea of the storyline. I mean, you're right that they could have had more of a reason for Vince to do that. I think Vince was kind of just relying. It didn't make Rick look good. It was because it sort of mirrored real life. I think that Vince sort of did want Rick to stop wrestling.
That's right.
And so he just came out and said, yeah, I want you to stop wrestling. Next time you lose, you're gone. Because, truth be told, I think Vince really did want Rick to stop
wrestling.
All
it did was call attention to how finished he was.
And I'll be honest with you,
mm-hmm.
he was. At this point, as much as we love Ric Flair, he's not without his faults. Watching him some of these matches, it was a little painful.
Here's the thing,
I remember watching this show live, and a buddy of mine was like, Jesus, Rick, just give it up. and I wanted to defend Flair, and I couldn't.
You know what? And this is something that I completely don't understand how or why the science of something like this, and I'm not making fun of them because God knows none of us are looking forward to the day this happens to us. But between 03 and 05, if you watch the stuff, his hair fell off a cliff. He was like, dude, he still had the nice mane of hair by in 03.
Yeah, when he was managing.
And in 05, by 04, 05, he's having to do the slick back thing, and he's hardly got anything. And
he was still okay, though. He had good matches with Triple H at the end of 05.
No, true, but he
the
was.
The hair, you're right, the hair.
He was, like, the hair was mostly gone. He's been, like, where he is today, hairline-wise, he got there in, like, 04, 05. Overnight, it seemed like. And Kyle, I think that cosmetically probably plays into your impression of him at that time. For me, it was more of a slower decline
look old here. Now,
yeah,
he works against MVP. God bless.
U.S. champion non-title match, which they didn't even say it was non-title.
Sometimes I poo-poo you at being a nitpicking Nancy. I don't poo-poo you there. That always bothers me.
Yes.
It's so funny because now we're just so used to it. Them having a champion wrestle, and they don't mention it's a title match. The champion loses, and they don't even, like now on Raw when that happens. They don't even mention or make a big deal that a champion loses.
Maybe they were afraid that it would give away the ending. Although me thinks him wrestling MVP on a Royal Rumble show still gives away the ending.
So, all right, this storyline, the way it was conceived originally, I think could have worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the initial plan we were listening before we went on here. To Meltzer talk on a different podcast about the original storyline, and that when Steve Austin came up with it, which surprised me that Austin was the one who kind of came up, because he's never really been involved in any sort of official creative capacity with the company.
Yeah, but if you listen to him, he's got a great mind for booking.
Oh, no, I'm not denying that. Yeah. There's a lot of people that have great minds, though, that aren't sitting and making the important decisions for this company creatively. It was supposed to culminate with Rick challenging. Yes, it was supposed to culminate with Rick challenging for a world title at WrestleMania. That never happened. It just kind of went to a match versus Shawn Michaels, where we're all celebrating Ric Flair. He's going to lose, and the next night on Raw turned out to be the real highlight. So they tried here. I'll give them that. They tried to get over. This could be the last time you ever see Ric Flair.
Yeah.
You know, he cuts the promo beforehand. Oh, I remember coming here to MSG, you know, before some of you were even alive.
1976, they mentioned it a few times.
Michael Cole kind of reinforced that history. God bless him. You know, MVP interrupted Flair's promo for the cheap heat. But here's the issue with this. And I guess it was a reoccurring theme, and there's no way around it.
Mm-hmm.
You just got the sense that Ric Flair was not going to be retired in an opening match at the Royal Rumble.
Right.
By MVP. And I think that hurts this match a little bit, as does Rick looking a little old and quite frankly gassed by the match's end.
True, but I thought it still had pretty good heat. And that was just the relying on the crowd itself. It was a hot crowd.
It was, and it's the opener. I mean, the crowd generally is hot for the opener.
Right.
Ric Flair going over clean, by the way,
with the figure four. Which he never beat anybody with in his prime. How's he beating all these guys late in his career with a figure four?
I don't think that did MVP any favors.
No,
who was the U.S. champion who theoretically should have been a guy in an upward trajectory. I mean, again, they had to have Ric Flair beat somebody, and that somebody had to have some, you know, I mean, they couldn't have him wrestle Kurt Hawkins on this show, for instance.
Also, something else I noted in my notes here, and this goes back to our original point about the line of delineation 07 to 08. No mention here. MVP's a SmackDown guy, Ric Flair's a Raw guy. They just
again,
threw him out
the
there.
Softening of the brand extent. You're right. That's not even a big deal.
Yep.
There was a spot that they didn't do well. I have here. Charles Robinson. So they did the false finish.
Mm-hmm.
MVP covered Flair. Robinson counted three by accident, even though Flair's foot was on the rope. That was not sold well by Charles Robinson, MVP.
Right.
Maybe that's a nitpicking thing, but I'm going to point it
You're
out.
Right about that.
And I thought the crowd, he kind of started to die at that point.
Right.
But again, of course, Flair, like you said, he goes over Clint. The figure four was obvious he was going to go over. It was an okay opener. I thought it should have been better.
Well, here's the thing, too. You talk about no favors being done to MVP. On my long list of Lost Generation guys. MVP's one of them.
MVP deserved better. You know what, though? He got off to a bad start, and it took him a while to erase that stink, I feel. Remember, they did that weird way of introducing him where what they were going for is he's an overhyped guy. You know, it's kind of like in sports how some, like, this athlete will hype how good he is, and then he's not that good, and then there's this backlash against him. They didn't really do a good job of conveying that to the audience.
It's a hard way of making a money-drawing heel.
Yes. So what just kind of happened was everyone's like, oh, this guy sucks. You know?
Well, having said that, though, what I thought redeemed him was that excellent series. It probably took too long to put the U.S. title on him, but he had a great series with Chris Benoit. He really, really did in the spring of – it's the last accomplishment, really, of Benoit's career. And maybe the fact that it was – maybe the fact that they wanted to erase all things Benoit from memory, maybe that helped blunt his momentum, but he was still the U.S. champion. And serving him up to Flair in this situation here, maybe it's a sign – you know, you can look at it on the other hand and say, well, it's a sign of how much we've already elevated him, that people would take him seriously in this spot. I, like you, tend to agree with – he's slipping on the banana peel for a guy who's got less than 90 days left in the company.
And did they even do any build-up on TV for this? Really, between
very
Flair
little.
And I mean, obviously they did a lot of stuff with Vince saying, okay, this is your next match, but I don't think there was a lot of heat really between Flair and MVP on TV.
And as you've pointed out to me, too, off-air, that the shenanigans that they got into as the Flair thing went along of, like, DQ finishes and things like that, because
it just seemed like less important. It was like, what's the point?
Right.
It was just like, okay, Shawn Michaels is going to mercy kill him.
Right.
You know, it was like, why, as someone just in the audience watching, it was kind of like, why do we want Rick to continue wrestling? Obviously, you know, I'm a Ric Flair fan, and he's been around forever. He's one of the best ever.
Right.
But, you know, there comes a point where it's like, okay, well, what's this building towards? I think they lost sight of that.
I agree.
Speaking of shenanigans, we had a Vince McMahon Hornswoggle promo.
During their father-son goofiness.
Yeah, just in case if people have forgotten, Ken Kennedy was originally supposed to be the bastard child of Vince McMahon. He then made a complete ass out of himself, defending the company, claiming he'd never used steroids, and then, like, a day later, I think it turned out he used steroids.
Yep.
And so he got screwed out of that storyline. WWE didn't know what to do, so they just made Hornswoggle. It was terrible. So that was in there. Finley, you know, McMahon kept telling, don't trust anybody. And this played into that Finley storyline. Finley is a baby face that really didn't go anywhere.
I didn't like Finley as a face with Hornswoggle because it was bad. I liked Finley earlier in 07 doing the sort of poor man's Austin ass-kicker gimmick. I liked that that ass-kicker face Finley.
You love to call people poor man's Austin.
I loved that run. I loved that run that Finley had before.
Finley's a talented performer, but this was kind of goofy. Mike Adamley debuted on this show.
Right. All he did was introduce the highlight video with JBL and Jericho setting up the feud. That was it.
Well, and then later, let's just mention the faux pas now. Now, if you watch this on the network, you probably don't have this unless you remember it. The infamous Jeff Harvey line. Do you know what I noticed?
Oh, see, I did only watch it on the network. I never watched this at the time. Okay.
You don't remember Jeff Harvey?
Set it up for me and for everybody. I remember vaguely what you're talking about, but
when he introduced the video package for Jeff Hardy, Randy Orton, which is the Raw title match on the show, he said, oh, and now it's time to talk about one of the great competitors, Jeff Harvey, or something like that. He called him Jeff Harvey, and the crowd really turned on him.
Okay.
But you know what's funny?
What?
It's edited off the network.
Yeah.
They don't have him say Jeff Harvey, because
that's why I didn't know what you were talking about specifically.
There was this glitch. I can't believe you don't remember. Like, all I think of Mike Adamley is Jeff Harvey.
I remember him botching stuff in general, but if you put a gun to my head, I couldn't have told you
the
specific.
That's the only thing I remember from Mike Adamley's entire run. That and when they tried making him the GM.
Oh, yeah. That was bad.
Adam Lee's originals.
Well,
those were heinous.
Well, the funny thing is, too, it almost made you believe it was a shoot. Later in the year, it was such a god-awful decision to use SummerSlam for your first Batista-Cena match almost as a throwaway when they had Adam Lee announce it as his idea. I'm sitting there going, I almost half believe that.
So, Jeff Harvey is a moment that will live in announcing infamy with wrestling. So the second match, though, on this show is JBL versus Chris Jericho.
Yeah.
This was the first pay-per-view match back. No, it wasn't. Not for Jericho, because obviously he had wrestled in the previous pay-per-view. And
Armageddon JBL 07, got him, I believe. Yeah.
Against Randy Orton.
Yeah.
And JBL cost him the title setting this up. But both guys had just sort of, well, for JBL, this is his first pay-per-view back as a wrestler.
Right.
Or, pardon me, as a sports entertainer. And Jericho had recently come back as well. I don't remember this feud very well, but I'll tell you this. I didn't mind it. I thought the setup, the video package that Mike Adamly kicked it to, did a really good job with this. And do you know what I was thinking?
It's always goofy when they get into the faux family stuff, though. You know, like, yo, your kids are going to have to watch you get decimated.
I didn't mind. You know what I was thinking when I was watching this entire video package and match, the whole thing unfold? JBL can be a really good heel as long as he's not the world champion. Like, obviously, when you think of JBL in this role, everyone always thinks of his horrible run.
That interminable stretch, yes.
But when I watch this, I'm like, you know, this guy could be an effective heel in this position on the card. Absolutely.
Well, and the thing of it is, too, is that, and this is one of the things, and this guy, I'm not praising him for this as an announcer, because he is one of the many announcers they have these days. It just sets my teeth on edge. But one of his strengths as a speaker, whether it be as an announcer or as a wrestler, is that he is able of speaking with such conviction. He has more power in his speech and how he is getting something across than do most guys that they have.
Yes. So I kind of like the setup for this. So in case if you forgot, and it's easy to forget things from this era, Jericho was challenging Randy Orton for the title, and he was thrown into JBL, who was doing commentary, and then JBL got offended by that and attacked him. I don't mind that. That's old school wrestling.
It is different.
And it's one of those things where if you're to be an effective heel, you have to kind of convey, you know, you have to think you're right, even if you're not. And like, you know, like it's kind of like the old bar thing, you know, a guy bumps into you and like a guy takes such offense to it. I thought JBL did a good job with that, even though if it resulted in a terrible finish on the pay-per-view.
Yeah, you can't ignore Jericho that part of it, too. I mean, and they listen, they weren't going to put the title on Jericho coming right back in, so they had to get out of that somehow.
I thought that was an effective way to do it. Also, I you know, whenever I hear a larynx injury, because they did a big injury angle, JBL attacked him, I thought that was a pretty good segment, at least the way
Steamboat,
they edited it.
Basically?
Yes, yeah. Larynx. Yes, yeah. Anytime you have injure the larynx, I always think of Ricky Steamboat, Randy Savage. So props there. I think this was the only other time I've heard of an injured larynx, quite frankly, besides the Steamboat Savage one. But they did a really cool... I thought the video package that made it look probably better than it actually was, that segment with JBL injuring Jericho. And while this match isn't great, I thought it was pretty effective by the end of it, by the time... And it goes to an awful DQ finish. But by the time...
It protected both guys, which they wanted to do.
Yeah, but what was odd is I don't remember this feud necessarily being blown off. I know they were both in the Elimination Chamber the next month, but I thought when this was over, the crowd was into it.
I want to touch on what you said there, because the setup for this thing, the setup was that this was going to be a months-long blood feud. This essentially was, I don't know if you could call it a blow-off, but it's the closest thing there was to it. It was all building to this match, and then pretty much nothing
beyond
it.
What did Jericho do at WrestleMania 24?
Jericho was in the Money in the Bank match, I believe. Was he not?
Was he?
I believe so.
Let me look that up. Because, obviously, by the end of 08, Jericho really reinvented himself as the heel in the feud with Shawn Michaels, and did some, quite frankly, the best work of his career. Was he in that?
They didn't have anything else for him at, and you and I are Googling this here at the same time.
I'm
like 99.9% sure.
That he was in the Money in the Bank ladder match? Really?
Yeah.
JBL, I know, wrestled Finley.
They transitioned him into a feud with Finley.
He was. Yeah. He was. Jericho was in the Money in the Bank ladder match.
Okay.
You're absolutely 178% right.
Having said that, I'm not going to necessarily criticize that because you can't have storylines for everybody at WrestleMania. There's always going to be some guys that have to get bumped into that. And in a way, that may have played into the beginning of the Seeds of Discontent heel turn. Jericho's run in 08 and 09, I think, was the best of his career.
Yeah. I believe he won Wrestler of the Year for 2008 in the Observer, very prestigious award. Thank you very much.
It began to play into his resentment storyline, even if they didn't show it at the time. Yeah. But, yeah, this feud ended weirdly.
Okay, but you talked about a blood feud. We did get blood here. That took me back because that's what made me think, okay, we're not PG yet because we have blood in this match. The DQ is lame, but they did atone for it post-match with Jericho choking JBL. I thought the crowd got into it.
Going
I thought
to
they
the
made
whole
up
thing
for it
of, yeah.
As payback for the larynx injury.
Well, yeah, and the funny thing, two things I thought of with that. One was looking back at the Texas Death Match with superstar Billy Graham and Dusty Rhodes in the Garden in 78. They kind of used cables in a lot of the same kind of way.
Yeah, the way they did it. People should check this out. It was unique because you didn't see that a lot.
Also,
with the use of the cables,
by the way,
to choke the guy out.
And I understand it was later this year they become PG, but 2.5 years later, the predominant reason Daniel Bryan is fired is for choking a guy. Talk about moving the goalposts.
Yeah.
I made a note of that during this match. How are you going to look Daniel Bryan in the eye and say, we don't do that here, when these guys are working that into a match? So
that was 2.5 years.
Overreaction. Before. Total overreaction.
2.5 years.
This was a good match.
The match itself wasn't good. I just thought it was effective. I think by the end they had gotten to where they wanted to go. For considering the finish of the actual match, this was surprisingly satisfying by the end. That's what I would say about it. Because there was a bot, Jericho botched a knee lift. They kind of lost the crowd for a while. With that and the DQ finish, they really risked losing the crowd here, but Jericho got him back with the post-match attack.
It did what it needed to do, basically, in terms of telling a story. By the way, Wikipedia indicates that we did not get to see on the network the dark match of Shannon Moore and Jimmy Wang Yang against Deuce and Domino. Moore and Wang went over. We probably missed nothing with that. I'm sure you would agree.
Deuce and Domino.
Yeah.
Deuce is right.
Yeah.
I was a little disappointed in JR not giving us a Ted Irvine reference here in this match. I think this is the first time anytime Jericho wrestled in the Garden, you could always count on, Jericho's father played hockey in this arena for the New York Rangers. Didn't get it.
If it was a city where, someone's father had played college football, you better damn well be sure that
was disappointed in JR. His work was slipping.
It was. A little bit. Just a little.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classics, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.